From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. There is a lot we can talk about going on with the Korean Peninsula this week, mostly to deal with North Korea. Not only have they launched two ICBM tests in the last month, the UN has also passed extremely strong sanctions against them. And now in the last 24 hours, we've had really strong rhetoric going back and forth between the Trump administration and the Kim regime. So in order to talk about and break down all of the things that have been going on, I wanted to sit down with some of our great experts here from the Korea Economic Institute. So we're here with three of our experts. First is our Vice President, Mark Tokola, who spent a long time in the U.S. Foreign Service and should have a lot of interesting insights from his experiences. We have Troy Stangaron, our Senior Director for Congressional Affairs and Trade, who's been following all these issues very closely for a number of years. And then we have Kyle Ferrier, who is our Director of Academic Affairs and Research, and of course has been following this not only from the perspective of the security relationship, but he also has a particular specialty in the economics as well. So we should have a lot of good things to talk about. We're going to try to break down some of the stuff that's been happening for you. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. All right, guys, so we have a lot to talk about in the last few weeks dealing with North Korea. Yesterday, we had not only a report from the Washington Post saying that North Korea's capabilities are farther along than we expected, but then also a very strong response from the president afterwards. So my first question, I guess, is what the heck is going on here?
Well, first, I mean, clearly we're at a point to where North Korea is pushing forward on their programs at a rapid pace. In terms of the Washington Post report, I feel as though that this is a situation where they're not necessarily reporting new news. The U.S. military for a while has assumed that they've had the ability to take in place a nuclear weapon on a ballistic missile capable of reaching Japan, Guam, other parts of perhaps the Pacific, for at least a year or so now, maybe a little longer. This is sort of a reconfirmation, if you will, of what others have concluded rather than, I think, really new news. Beyond that, we're in a much more, I think, tense situation. There's a report out today that the Blue House is saying, you know, there's not a crisis on the peninsula. On one level, I agree with that, but clearly we are at a critical point in trying to resolve the North Korean nuclear issue.
Anything to add to that?
Well, it's true they made some big steps in the missile program, and it's happening faster than people expected, but they still haven't demonstrated they can deliver a nuclear warhead to the continental U.S. They've got their ICBM missile, and they've shown pictures of a nuclear warhead, and they've done some underground nuclear testing, but they haven't shown reentry capability yet. They've not shown they'd actually put a nuclear weapon in a rocket and fly it. So I'm not sure how they're going to prove they can do that, at what point it becomes not only prudent to assume that they do, but for them to be able to argue they actually can do it.
I would think that, you know, once they demonstrate reentry is probably when that'll be the case, because it's difficult, you know, what we don't know is what is the weight of the payload they're putting in the missiles themselves. And so that's always going to be difficult to determine. But once they demonstrate reentry, the difficulty becomes then, I think, from a planning point, you have to assume that they could mount it on that weapon, and that if it were to be launched, that's when I think we start getting into hazier areas, because then it comes questions of, do you need to shoot something down? Because now you no longer know, because they have demonstrated reentry.
And I think there's a dichotomy clearly between how the South Koreans view this, the United States views this. The South Koreans have been under the attack range of the North Koreans for a number of years now, and now this is the first time that the United States may possibly come under that umbrella as well. So we're looking at a difference of positioning here by the United States, whereas the South Koreans don't necessarily view this as big of a change as Washington does.
Well, and I would just add on to that, you know, this is something I should give credit. You know, Bruce Klingner has said, I think, multiple times publicly that, you know, as you note, South Korea and Japan are already under this threat. The United States shouldn't be simply saying, oh, well, it's unacceptable now that we're under that threat as well, because these are allies and, you know, they're having to deal with this challenge as well.
And beyond that, there are already 300,000 Americans living in Japan and South Korea. So Americans are under threat today.
Yeah, and I mean, this is why, you know, whether you want to call it preventative or preemptive attacks are difficult, because when people say things like, you know, well, they'll die over there than over here, that's not really true, because you do have a large number of Americans' lives who would be at risk.
So this is one thing that I definitely wanted to get into a little bit, because this term preventative war or preventative strike has been thrown around a lot, including by General McMaster in the last few weeks. And that was prior to some of the more fiery, shall we say, rhetoric in the last 24 hours. So first of all, can you guys give us a quick explanation? What exactly is preventative as opposed to preemptive? Because those are two very different things. And what should, in your opinion, be our tactic here? Is should that be on the table?
A preventative strike would be a military attack on North Korean nuclear and missile facilities with the expressed objective of preventing the program from completing its capabilities and hopefully perhaps sending it back years, if not permanently ending the program. A preemptive attack would be one where we have what we believe to be credible intelligence that the North Koreans are in the process of preparing to strike either, you know, South Korea, Japan, or the United States, or some other, you know, country with a nuclear weapon, and we engage in a strike with the sole purpose of ensuring that they are unable to do that and take out the program then. So one is essentially trying to ensure that it's a problem you don't face in the future. The other is having taken up to the point to where you no longer have a choice because you believe that the North Koreans are going to actually utilize the weapons.
So it's basically a matter of timing.
To an extent, yes. I think the difference is that one is a clear sense of self-defense. If you are under the threat of attack, it's one thing to take and remove a threat. It's another to take and remove the threat so that way you never face the risk of potentially being under attack.
What do you guys think about these two options being on the table, as the administration has said they are?
I'm not sure it's so binary. I'm not sure it's just attack or not attack. I think there's all kinds of degrees of things you could do. Like it's gotten harder to see where their missiles are because they've made them mobile. The most recent launch was one that was sent off a mobile platform someplace in western North Korea. So it's not like we can just watch the platforms anymore. Another possibility is some kind of a demonstration attack, something you could do in a limited area just to show that patience has run out. You could attack a submarine base at some time designed to minimize casualties. The problem with that idea is that Kim Jong-un is probably not going to be able to recognize when an attack is limited. He probably assumes any attack would be the beginning of a campaign to come after him. So I'm not sure he could do a demonstration attack, but people have talked about it.
Mark mentioned there are a number of options, but we should also be very cognizant of how we frame these options on the table and how our allies perceive we are talking about these issues. I think to many South Koreans that the way that it's been discussed so far, it's been in a very unilateral sense, and they feel a bit alienated. So it's important to, when we make these distinctions between what is and what isn't on the table, that we also talk about our relationship with our South Korean allies as well.
And the other option that people have kind of forgotten about, or not option, but possibility, would be a North Korean conventional attack, which they've not done for a long time. Back in 2010, the North Korean shelled a South Korean island, and they sank a South Korean naval vessel. We had the landmine incident, which injured some South Korean soldiers. So is it possible that Kim Jong-un may, rather than do further nuclear testing, might do a conventional provocation? And how would Moon Jae-in respond to that? How would you respond to it?
And I mean, the difficulty with some of this is that even if we did, as you said, say a demonstration attack, he doesn't necessarily have to respond kinetically. And I think that's one of the things that people don't talk about enough. You know, if you look at how North Korea is trying to develop their cyber capabilities and everything, you know, in South Korea, they've gone after banks, media, government sites and things. There's nothing to preclude them from, say, going after a U.S. power utility and putting, say, the northeastern U.S. in the dark for a week or something. You know, just to simply say, remember, we can touch you as well.
This is a good point. I actually wanted to talk about the cyber option. I know several months ago there was a report that the U.S. had been using cyber to try to delay the North Korean nuclear program from going forward. So is there Is there that option that hasn't actually been talked about that much in the last few weeks, but is there something in the cyber realm that we could do instead of a physical attack here?
The North Koreans, after Stuxnet, became very paranoid of basically, one, sharing at least electronically information with the Iranians because they were concerned that it might be compromised with viruses. Two, as well, with their own. I have no doubt, I mean, even before the New York Times story on this came out, that we would try this because, I mean, it's a clear, logical thing to do. That being said, now that they are at the stage they are on the missiles, I'm, one, skeptical that what we've seen in terms of their failures was related to, you know, our cyber attacks, because if you were in their systems, it would make more sense to save any, what it's called, left of launch, basically, type activities until after they had the program and you thought they were going to attack, rather than to take and do it to slow the program, because that would be more critical in the long run, having the ability to basically sabotage North Korean missiles during an attack, as opposed to simply delaying for a short period of time their own progress. Because just like with the Iranians, you know, eventually you're going to figure out that either there's a bug there or what the technical issue that you've got wrong.
So I know Kyle brought this up, and this is a really important point. Obviously, we have to think about the South Koreans, our allies, but we also have a relatively new president in South Korea who took a little bit of a softer line as far as the engagement with North Korea, at least during his campaign, although now he seems to be wanting to move forward with some things like that and things like that. So what do you think is Moon Jae-in's thought process at the moment, with tensions maybe a little bit higher than he would want? And then also, what do you make of some of his changes in terms of things like that?
So Moon Jae-in, from what I've seen so far, has been much more accommodating to what we would perceive U.S. policy to be than what he had said he would pursue as a North Korean policy under his campaign. I think a lot of that really has to do with the realization of the imminent threat from the North Koreans, and how there is a lack of immediate desire for talks from the North Koreans. And that said, he is still very much focused on pursuing a number of his own domestic agenda reforms. And I think he would much rather be working on reforming the South Korean economy than dealing with these flare-ups from North Korea. So it's sort of, there's this dichotomy in that he is working around between balancing between the United States and dealing with the North Koreans, as well as trying to reform and revitalize the South Korean economy.
Yeah, I think Moon Jae-in is very disappointed that his overtures led to nothing from North Korea. Now, within weeks of his inauguration and within days of his meeting with President Trump, North Koreans were launching ICBMs. The North Korean state media has said that Moon Jae-in is no different from his predecessors and may be worse. So he's being rebuffed, and he can't do this by himself. And I think he will not want to be in the position of appearing to beg North Korea and have them slap him. I think Kyle's point is important, too, that Moon Jae-in has domestic priorities that are actually more important to him than North Korea. He has a 100-point plan that was released in July about what he wants to accomplish in 5 years. And on the list of 100 items, North Korea is toward the bottom. He also wants to do constitutional reform. He promised that. That'll be a very time-consuming, labor-intensive effort on his government's part. I think North Korea offered an opening, and Moon Jae-in would be quick to take it, but I'm not sure in advance of the local elections in 2018 and National Assembly elections in 2020, he'll want to be in a position of being embarrassed by trying to do something that's failing North Korea.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, you know, this is a critical period for South Korea, setting aside even, you know, North Korea itself. You have, you know, demographic issues they need to solve. You have, because of the impeachment with Park Geun-hye, you need to sort of, and Moon Jae-in has done a good job so far early on, but it'll take more than simply his own popularity, but restoring confidence in government in South Korea. You need economic reform because they have labor market issues. You know, there's broader issues internationally in terms of trade. While it's been up, the expectation is that it's going to start, you know, peaking again here soon. So, I mean, there's a lot in terms of just South Korea's own future that needs to be dealt with, and that probably can't be pushed off much longer.
I mean, not to mention the head of Korea's biggest company being on trial at the moment. So that's another big story that people are probably following very closely. I unfortunately can't avoid talking about the comments yesterday, the fire and fury that will rain down upon North Korea should they continue their threats. What was your response when you saw those comments, and where do we go from here, I guess?
Fire and fury, when you hear something like that, the first thing that comes to mind is essentially, you know, the North Korean sort of long-term rhetoric of turning Seoul into a sea of fire. So, you know, it's clearly it's stronger rhetoric than has been used, in a long time by perhaps, you know, any U.S. president in relation to North Korea. Yes, President Bush did refer to it as part of the axis and evil, but that was more a defining characteristic as opposed to, you know, an active policy of what he would potentially do to North Korea. In terms of where do we go from here, President Trump is clearly someone who likes to be colorful in his rhetoric, and I think that's just the nature of, you know, his presidency. When we look at this more broadly, though, the various options you have on the table, if you were to take and engage in some kind of military conflict with North Korea to try and eliminate the program, one, you run the risk of significant response by the North Koreans. So if you layer this out, there's the perhaps non-zero but very low chance the North Koreans simply, you know, take the attack and move on. There's the much more likely potential response that they at least engage in some kind of response, either conventional or nuclear, towards South Korea or Japan. And so once you do that, you start getting into higher costs in terms of physical damage, loss of human life, and if there is significant damage to South Korea or Japan, the natural response, both of political leaders there and others, would be a need to counter-respond to North Korea. And once you start getting into counter-responses, you don't know how far this could spread. And so now you're potentially moving or slipping into a war. And if you slip into a broader conflict of that nature, the difficulty is it's unclear whether China would stay in or out of such a war. Much of that will likely depend on how they view the calculus in terms of their interests. But, you know, this could all lead to, you know, significant loss of human life. And one of the things that I mentioned earlier, you know, there's this idea like, well, but, you know, it would be over there, it wouldn't be over here. I don't think that that's a good assumption, especially if you end up in a conflict between the United States and China. You know, the idea that that conflict might not spread just simply beyond the Korean Peninsula, I think, is a very poor assumption to make. And so, you know, we're at a very critical point, but because the military option is potentially so grim, you know, that means basically you have the option of, one, continuing to tighten the sanctions and hoping that we can bring Kim Jong-un not to his knees, but to his senses. And in the process of that, you know, trying to take and find a way to revive talks. But beyond simply sanctioning North Korea or trying to revive talks, we need to start looking at this as a more multifaceted problem and using more than simply one tool at our disposal. So that means, you know, we need to start considering, you know, more seriously, you know, information penetration. We need to start looking at deterrence more. I mean, these are all things we have done to a small extent, but we need a much broader policy. And we need to start thinking about this both in terms of how do we try to prevent the North Koreans from finishing the program and prevent it in a way that doesn't lead to significant loss of life, but also take and look at this in terms of, you know, given the where they are the program, what steps do we take once we decide that they do have a workable ICBM? Because this isn't simply a question of how do you stop them, but it's also a question of what do you do if you don't succeed in that. And I mean, to not have a backup plan, if you will, would simply not be good policy.
Well, because Troy says the danger of war is so high, it's virtually everyone agrees we need to get to a diplomatic solution. There needs to be negotiation. So what are we going to look for in the negotiations? We want denuclearization, verifiable, complete. What do the North Koreans want? They want regime survival. Kim Jong-un's only goal is stay in power. So I think when you hear Rex Tillerson talk about North Korea not being our enemy and not looking for regime change, that's a step toward that negotiation. When you talk about removing him from his weapons or fire and fury, it seems like that's kind of a step away from those negotiations.
Interestingly, I think Troy was the first one so far, about 20 minutes in, to mention the word sanctions, even though the UN just passed a new round of sanctions less than a week ago. Are those new sanctions helpful? Are they enough? What's going on with the UN at the moment?
Well, clearly they're helpful and a step in the right direction, but this is the third round of sanctions in 2 years. This new round of sanctions takes what was passed in March of last year, November of last year, and now it adds another layer of measures against the North Koreans. It blocks all of its coal exports, as well as adds new sectoral bans on a number of other important areas that are for North Korean exports. But as with previous sanctions, why we keep needing to enact new rounds is because of loopholes and exceptions and really enforcement issues. So this newest round of sanctions looked fairly airtight, but it will depend on how some countries meet the letter as opposed to the spirit of the agreement, as well as how well the North Koreans can sort of move to the next economic source of hard currency.
There's been a change in the philosophy behind sanctions, too. You know, the earliest round of sanctions were targeted toward dual-use technologies and had to be specifically tied to the North Korean nuclear missile programs. These new rounds of sanctions seem to be way beyond that. And they've ramped up in accordance with North Korea's ramping up of its program. Now the goal is to cripple the North Korean economy, not to hurt the people, but to deprive the regime of money from any source. So the fish sanctions, the coal, going after overseas workers, it seems like there's a more intense effort now to try to squeeze the North Korean regime. That's probably appropriate.
Oh, and it's interesting. There's apparently a couple U.S. court cases right now to where some of the documents that have been released indicate that roughly 95% of what was supposedly, you know, livelihood coal trade was actually going directly into the government's pockets as opposed to people. So, you know, while we talk about, well, what will the impact be on the populace, if these documents are accurate, and you can make a case maybe they're not, and that's why we'll have these court cases, even if you do see this drop off, you're likely not to see the type of impact you might have expected on the populace, because if it was already all being funneled to the regime and the weapons programs, then, you know, there's very likely to be little impact on them.
Okay. Well, we have, of course, a lot that we are going to be continuing to follow. We're going to be continuing to talk about, but I really want to thank you guys for taking a few minutes out of your day to talk to me about all the things that have been going on with North Korea this week.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for once again joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please feel free to subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and join us again next week for another great episode.